So we're going to talk about some methods you can use in machine learning to prevent overfitting. So yesterday we talked about how we might identify if we're overfitting our data by using test data in addition to our training data. And today we're going to talk about what we can actually do to modify our algorithms if we find that we are overfitting. And then we're actually going to go back to talking about physics finally. So we're going to talk about specifically the application of how we can use these supervised neural networks that we've developed to try to train them to learn things about phases of matter. So we're going to see if we can train machines to learn phases of the Ising model. You're going to do that on homework one. And we're also going to talk about training a machine to learn phases of the Ising Z2 gauge theory, which in this case, the theory actually has topological order, so it's a bit harder to learn, as we're going to see. Okay, so let's talk about methods that prevent overfitting. So one method we can use, something called either L1 or L2 regularization. How many people have heard of that before? Just one? OK. Do you want to say what it is? No? OK. All right. So the idea in this case is that what we actually do is we modify our cost function. And now the cost function is also going to depend on the actual magnitude of our weights in our network. Okay, so in this case, our cost function would be whatever we were using initially. So the ones we've seen so far are mean squared error or cross entropy. But then the term that we add to it would just be some sum over all of my weights. And if I'm using L2 regularization, I sum the square of all of those weights. Yeah, it's another hyperparameter. Yeah, we should make a list of all of them. I'll do that for tomorrow, actually. You can realize all these hyperparameters that you have to do additional fitting on. Yeah.
Are you also summing over your input, like x?
No. So you are in the C initial expression, but this one doesn't actually depend on. No, it doesn't depend on x. It just depends on the weights in your network. But you just divide by the magnitude of your data set, I guess, so that it scales in the same way as this function. But there's no x dependence there, so you don't need to sum over x. But that's a good question. And then if we use L1 regularization, it's very similar, except we just take the magnitude of your weights. Thank you. So again, this lambda, it's yet another hyperparameter. We can consider two extreme cases of this. We want to adjust this lambda until we get something that is going to help us describe our data well. So if we take it too small, do we expect to overfit or underfit our data? It's really small.
Well, then also the contribution of this additional thing will be very small.
Mm-hmm.
So we won't definitely like overfit, right? We want to minimize the cost function.
Mm-hmm.
So we won't overfit. Maybe with time, yes, but yeah.
So you're saying if this is too small, then you think we will not overfit.
Oh, we will overfit.
We will overfit, yeah.
The cost function won't change much.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect, yeah. So exactly, if we make this too small, we're not actually going to be doing much to solve our problem, and we might still overfit. But if you make it too big, you can actually underfit your data.
Comparable with like average meaning of cost function, right? It shouldn't be much bigger than it or much.
No. I guess it depends on your. So you're saying if you were to look at the average of your cost function and.
Well, at least the lambda should be something around it. It shouldn't be 10 times bigger and 10 times smaller, right?
I don't know, actually. I'm not sure. Because I guess what really matters is the gradients of your cost function in the end. So. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's papers on this, but I don't know if there's. It would definitely be all about the gradients, but, and I'm sure there you can read about different situations where people have written about what they think the optimal value of lambda is for various types of data. But it's again, it's not. I don't think there's anything where you can say always set it to this value or. Okay, so what's the effect of adding this term? Our network will favor smaller weights now. So what is this really going to mean, though? Why do we actually want it to have small weights? Why don't we want it to have big weights? Well, imagine that we take some of our data points that we're training on and we add a little bit of noise. If we are encouraging our network to have smaller weights, then when we make small changes to our data, it's less likely that we're going to notice big changes in our output, which is what we would usually expect. Does anybody have any questions about that?
I have a question. Why do we even need this thing if we can just run our neural network again and again and again on the same data with a bit of noise in it, every time a random noise, and then just see on which point they all provide, you know, like their closest neighbor, whatever, in which case they give you the same, answer.
Yeah, that's another option. So I don't know if, I'm not sure if I'm quite understanding what you're saying, but.
I imagine it will be evolving.
Yeah.
At some point it will be at the stage when, it's not optimal with this particular noise, and then it will, try to optimize itself, and then you add a different noise, and again, it will go to the stage which is not optimal.
So
you just take the stage which is, all the same among all of the different added noise, which means
all the same. Yeah, Yeah. So I think this is basically another method. No, but you're basically describing another thing that we could do, which is that we could just take our data set and we could add a bunch of noise to it and we could make sure we train on that.
And then the new noise.
Yeah, that's just another thing. Yeah.
Does the same type of...
But not even necessary. Yeah, you could do that. You could look at a bunch of different networks and make sure they're all converging to the same place. That's right.
Yeah,
but the point is that what we were seeing before is that remember in that tutorial, we could see that it was overfitting. It was getting these weird features in the data that it was trying too much to describe the training data, right? So even though we knew it was happening, running it longer wasn't going to make that go away, right? It was just...
I'm not saying run it longer. Just imagine you run it 10 times, every time with a different noise, and every time it's overfitting, but don't take the overfitting as your final decision.
Mm-hmm.
Take something beforehand.
Oh, I see.
Which is kind of...
Before it starts overfitting?
Among all of the models with different noise. So you take
two models, I see.
Different noise, and you just take that stage, which is the same among
mm-hmm.
all of them.
Yeah.
So you kind of...
No, you could. In what I'm describing here, I'm not actually saying to train on data with more noise.
Uh-huh.
What you're describing is actually taking your data and modifying it to
modifying
do something.
It, yes. Yeah. So find kind of a universal, network.
Yeah. And that's a really good approach as well. That makes sense, definitely. So what I'm describing here is just if you do this, your network is just less likely to get into situations where it overfits. What we saw on Tuesday is that it was really easy to get into a situation where you were overfitting. It happens really quickly on some data sets, right? The one we were looking at was maybe kind of a toy example, but we saw there that right away, it was overfitting. Whereas if you add this regularization, you're going to see that you're going to get curves that make a lot more sense and they're not overfitting these data points. So yeah, there's lots of different things you can do, but this is just one thing. Okay. Another thing we can do, something called dropout. And what this means is that when we're training, at a given time, we randomly select some neurons in our network and we just don't use them. Okay, so let's draw a picture of what this might look like. Okay, so let's say I start with this very small and simple network. Sorry, I'm not doing this smart. One, two. Okay, so if this was my initial network, maybe at some point in time, I randomly choose to ignore these middle two neurons in the hidden layer. Oh, I should emphasize, in the hidden layer. And then we're going to train only using whatever neurons are left over. So what we would do is we would run our regular training algorithm using this modified network for some subset of data. Thank you. And then we would choose a different masking out. So then after we've done that for some subset of data, we would then randomly select some different neurons in the hidden layer to mask out. So basically what you can think of the effect of this method is that it's kind of what would happen if we were to average over many networks. So, you know, every time we mask out neurons, we have a different network architecture, or not a different architecture, sorry, but we have, because we still have the same kinds of connections, but we have a different network with different weights and biases. So this is just like as if we were to train. In a way, it's as if we were training many different networks, so they're going to get to many different states, and we're averaging over those effects. We can imagine that each of those networks on their own, they might overfit our data in a specific way, but we're averaging over all of those overfitting effects so that overall our network won't overfit as badly. Okay. Does anybody have questions about that? Yeah.
Do you have to modify your whole gradient descent not to account for these, or do you just set them to zero?
So you don't have any, you wouldn't have any connections here, yeah. So you would only be, yeah, you would only be using these connections. So yeah, you do have to modify that. Yeah. That's a good question. And your back propagation as well. You would also not propagate anything back through here, just through these ones.
This is only working for feed forward, I assume, neural networks. This.
Yeah, this is it. I mean, I don't know if there's any more general modification that you can use in other algorithms, but what I'm describing here is specifically for these feed forward neural networks.
Is for training only?
Pardon?
The dropout part, this is just on the training or?
As opposed to like the testing or something? Yeah, when you test it, you would put everything in. Yeah, yeah, this would be in training. Yeah.
Like every epoch, or every epoch we drop some and then train?
You can probably play around with that. Like you could do, yeah, it would be like another hyperparameter. There'd be like a few hyperparameters here, right? Like one could be what fraction of neurons you want to drop out. You could do it all the time or just some of the time. So yeah, it's another thing you can play with.
To do meta-machine learning, you need to
exactly.
Write a machine learning algorithm that analyzes all of the analyzed data and
yeah.
suggests you which hyperparameters we need.
Yeah, well, I have like, what, 15 of you? You can all do different one set of different parameters. Okay. Okay, so now let's talk about how we can use these networks to learn to distinguish phases of matter. So again, this week, I just want to emphasize we're still talking about supervised learning when we're going to be talking about these applications. But next week, we're also going to talk about how to distinguish phases of matter using unsupervised learning. And I wanted to emphasize that one of the very first papers in this area that kind of showed us how we can use machine learning to do this was actually done by two of your lecturers next week, Juan Carrasquilla and Roger Melco, back in 2016. So I would really recommend looking at this paper, especially when you're doing your homework one. It'll be really helpful to read through. Okay, so the first model we're going to consider, since it's many body physics, of course the easiest model we always start with is the icing model. So just to remind you, for an icing model, we're talking about Hamiltonian. And we can have a coupling parameter J, and then we can have this field term that we'll call H. The degrees of freedom that I'm calling sigma, they live on the sites of some lattice. So I can either have each sigma can either be plus one or minus one. Or when I'm drawing it, plus one will correspond to an up arrow, and minus one, a down arrow. So for example, on a 2D square lattice, so if I draw some lattice like that, this is just some configuration, sorry, that I can have. In this case, this would be an L by L lattice. And the size here is just L equals 4. So I need to adopt some labeling of my spins. So let's say that this first one is sigma 1, this one is sigma 2, this is sigma 3, sigma 4, and then I'm going to go up to the next row, sigma 5. Sigma 6, etc., all the way up to the last one, which in this case will be sigma 16. So I'm going to label them in that order. okay. So in 2D, we know that we have a phase transition in this model. So at low temperatures, we're going to be in a ferromagnetic phase. That's our ordered phase. And at high temperatures, we're going to be in a disordered paramagnetic phase. So, and just to remind you, when I turn off that field parameter, we know that this transition happens at a temperature of about 2.269 times the coupling strength. And we know from our StatMed class that in the thermodynamic limit, one quantity we could plot that would help us to visualize when this transition happens is called the order parameter, which in this case could be the magnetization. So if I draw a line where the transition is, my order parameter is going to be non-zero in this ferromagnetic phase and zero in the paramagnetic phase. Okay. Any questions about that? You guys remember Ising model stuff? Okay. Okay. So just to tie this in with what our goal is here. We want to train a neural network to learn how to classify these ferromagnetic and paramagnetic phases. And in this case, these are going to be our labels. And this is going to be homework one.
The input would be this.
That's what we're going to do just next. Yeah, I'm going to ask you. Yeah, so think about what you think it is. And I'm going to write it down and I'll just erase the board and then we'll. I'm glad you're like, yeah, that's the perfect question. Yeah. Okay, so what were you going to think? What were you going to say that you thought the input would be?
I thought that the input would be this ladder, so which in terms of coordinates and directions, right?
Okay, so I think you're basically right. So we are going to be putting in the configurations. We don't actually need to put in actual coordinates. All we need to put in
is directions, like say that sigma, we say how big our ladder is.
Yeah.
And well, then we know that it's a matrix and we know that position, it should be either the
So.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Perfect. Yeah. So. The input data is just spin configurations. So for the example that I wrote down over there, we can, I mean, you could store it as a matrix, but you can actually just store it as a long vector, which is what we were more used to the other days. So then in this case, it'll just be hopefully I did this right with that picture. Plus, plus, minus, plus, minus, plus. Yeah. OK. So in that, like, in this first location, we're just storing the value of sigma 1, sigma 2, et cetera. And this one would be sigma n. And my labels. Will just be 0 or 1, 0 if it's ferromagnetic, and 1 if it's paramagnetic. So in this case, we want to actually be able to train on labeled data. So given a configuration, we need to actually know, did it come from the ferromagnetic or paramagnetic phase? So in order to generate that data set, we use Monte Carlo simulation. So we run a Monte Carlo simulation at a given temperature, so we know if it's below or above the transition. And then using Monte Carlo, we get many different spin configuration samples. And then we will, we just know whether they're ferromagnetic or paramagnetic because we have knowledge of what the phase transition temperature is.
How many simulations, how big should be the training data, you think?
This is another thing, I guess, that you can play around with to see how much you need to really get the network to learn. But I think in what we're going to do, we're going to train on around 10,000 samples. Yeah. Okay. So this is going to be something that we'll talk about how to actually generate that Monte Carlo data tomorrow. We kind of talked about it in the StatMet class, but I just want to review some notation tomorrow because it's also actually going to be useful in the following weeks when we talk about some methods in unsupervised learning, because they actually, some methods in some of the algorithms we're going to study in unsupervised learning use some of the same sampling ideas as in Monte Carlo simulation. So we're going to review that tomorrow. But for now, I just want to also introduce the Z2 gauge theory. Those of you who took the condensed matter review might remember this. but we'll just review what we need to know for this course. And then you're going to look into this theory more in today's tutorial. Okay, so for my icing gauge theory, my Hamiltonian is a sum over all plaquettes of my lattice, and I'm going to draw what a plaquette is in just a minute. And then once I'm on a plaquette, I take the product over all site indices on that plaquette, and I multiply my degrees of freedom. In this case, the degrees of freedom are actually on the bonds of your lattice. Before, they were on the actual sites, but now they're going to be on the bonds. I'm going to draw a picture in just a second. So again, it's just plus 1 or minus 1. But if it's plus 1, when I have a bond on my lattice, I'm going to draw it with a circle on it. And otherwise, I'm just going to leave that bond empty. And what we consider is that we're on a two-dimensional torus. So a square lattice with periodic boundary conditions. So let me just draw. Again, this is. So when I say it's a torus or that it has periodic boundary conditions, what I'm really meaning is that if I have something over here, a part of my lattice over here, it connects back to this side. And same, once I get to the top, I connect back to the lower side. So I'm just drawing now an example of a state that we could have. So this is some state that I can have. Just whenever I put a circle on the bond, I'm saying that it's in state plus 1. And if I didn't draw anything, it just means it's in state minus 1. And what I mean when I talk about a plaquette is just a face on this lattice, so a square. Just choose a square, and I'm calling this a plaquette. So maybe I choose one where I have these two in this state. It doesn't really matter. Let's say that the indices of these, I'm calling the indices of these locations K, L, M, and N. And this plaquette is P. Then if I were to write out what this would be, the product over all indices that belong to that plaquette, and then multiplying sigma i. Did I write that wrong before? No. Okay. Sigma I. In this case, this would just be sigma k, sigma l, sigma m, sigma n.
So it can be either 1 or minus 1, right?
Each of the product? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the product and these, yeah, both can be either 1 or minus 1. Yeah. Just to emphasize, because this really is a torus, that another way I could draw this lattice is this torus shape, but I'm just drawing it in a flat way.
And in order to train a model for this, we give the array with plaquettes the values, right?
No, we're actually going to again give the just the sigma values. Yeah. You could do it with the plaquette values, but that would be too easy. We'll see. You'll see. Yeah. Yeah. I think it'll become clear, like especially after the tutorial, you'll appreciate why that would be. So we want to give the network as little information as possible about the actual theory. So if we were to tell it about those plaquettes, that's telling it kind of something that's important to the underlying physics, and we don't want to do that. Yeah.
So it has to figure out itself that the neighbors, you know, mean something.
Yeah, actually, that's another point. Even in the icing model, in the way we've explained this, we didn't tell it anything about, you know, it's probably more more important to look at your neighbors when you're doing things, which it is. We know that because that's the way we define the theory, but the network doesn't actually know that.
I understand, but then I have a question. How do you enumerate the sigmas in this case? Like before we just, you know, there are 16 squares and we would take 16 numbers, but in this case, because, you know, you have value on each.
Yeah, so in this case, we're going to have the number of spins, I call them spins, is going to be 2 times L squared.
Oh, okay.
So I just have to label them in some way. And you were going to see that in the tutorial as well. But I'm going to actually draw you like a better picture in the tutorial. But you'll see that we actually label them just like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in a way. As long as you're consistent, you can actually choose whatever you want as long as you're consistent all the time. Okay. So as you pointed out, the plaquette products are going to be either 0 or 1. And depending what they are, that's going to determine my energy. So what we ultimately want to do at low temperatures is that we tend to go into states with low energy. So assuming that our J is positive, we have a negative out here. What we really want is for every plaquette to have a positive product. So what that means is that there's 8 plaquettes that we prefer to have in this case. 8. Can anyone tell me just one of them? Just one plaquette that would give us...
If we need positive, then it's going to be everywhere just one. Right?
Yeah, everywhere one, yeah. So we could have it filled. We could also have it empty.
We can have empty. We can have the one that you draw.
Yeah, perfect. And any way that there could be 2 of them, right? Yeah, that's exactly right. What am I missing? 1, 2, 3, and then up. And then across. And then we have 8 plaquettes that we'll call excited because they're not in this low energy configuration. And these are going to be ones that are going to give me a product of -1. So they'll either have 1 or 3 spins in the plus state. So we don't have a finite temperature phase transition in this case. In the icing case, we saw that at a finite temperature of 2.269, we move into an ordered phase. In this case, we get a certain special kind of order only exactly at 0 temperature, but not at a finite temperature. So before, we in the icing model case, we saw that this magnetization was our order parameter, so a measure of how much order in our system. In this case, in order to measure the order in our system, we need to use a topological quantity. I'm going to write down what it is in just a sec. And so what we need to do to calculate this quantity is we need to take a product over spins on some curve but that curve needs to span our whole lattice. So for example, in the code that we're going to see this afternoon, we're always going to choose curves that are just either horizontal or vertical lines. So. So when I'm at zero temperatures, and then I'm thinking of the ground state, no matter which choice I have for this curve in either direction, I'm always going to get the same value for this. So it will always be plus one or minus one. OK, so now I just want to just use pictures, basically, to explain again to you what we're going to be doing in the tutorial and kind of why this problem is hard. So, and again, I've just written at the bottom here the reference where it was first, this was studied with machine learning, not where the icing model was first studied, but this paper is going to be what's relevant again later on the homework. But let me just show you these pictures, which are just samples from the ferromagnetic phase and the paramagnetic phase of the icing model. So that's the first one that we talked about. And in this case, the magnetization we saw is our order parameter. And what the magnetization basically does is it sums all of the spins in our system. But let's just pretend that, I mean, that I didn't tell you any of that. And I just showed you these configurations. Well, you could probably just learn by eye from at least the cases that are not very close to the critical temperature. But just looking at these cases, if I told you, OK, ferromagnetic phases look like this, and paramagnetic phases look like this, then if I showed you this one, what would you say? Is it ferromagnetic or paramagnetic?
Ferromagnetic.
Yeah, exactly. And if I showed you this one, what would you say? Yeah, exactly. It's very easy, right? Our eyes can very naturally learn this. We can just see by eye what the features are that we're supposed to learn. Even if I didn't tell you, oh, you need to calculate a magnetization, and this is what your Hamiltonian is. So I didn't tell you anything. I didn't tell you anything about the structure of my system or the order parameter. Still, your eyes could very easily learn this. But let's compare this with the case of the gauge theory. In this case, now I'm showing you two different configurations. And one of them is just a completely random high temperature configuration. And one of them is actually from this ordered space. And I've even explained to you guys the theory of how you might determine whether it's in an ordered state. So you know, you could look over all the plaquettes and try to figure out. So look at these, and I'm just wondering if anyone can tell me which one is the ordered state.
I think this one is the ordered, because if you very quickly calculate the number of the black spots in each line, it should be 4 or 8, something, you know.
In each line?
Yeah, like if you go.
I don't think it actually needs to be the same. So because
it's not the same, but it should be either 2 or, like, you know, the odd number.
Oh, I see. Yeah. You actually have to be careful, though, of which. Oh, I see.
At least it's like there is a consistency there. Well, here you can have some time, I think.
So this is 5 or 9. This is actually a slide that I took from Juan. He's often shown this at talks, and I know that when he first showed it, I was also really convinced. Oh, it's got to be this one. I can tell. I'm calculating this.
It's more ordered, right?
Yeah.
Than this one. This one looks more like random. But I can imagine that it's a trick.
Yeah. Sometimes you look at it and you get really convinced. Like this one looks more random. I know it. So anyway, I actually can't remember which is which, so I don't even know. But I have it written down. No, I have it written down, but I mean, I'm not going to show it yet until I want you all to look at it just for a couple more seconds. See if you want to try to convince yourself which one it is.
Well, at least every time I look here, in every line there, like an odd number of even.
So you think this one is the ordered state? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Should we vote? How many people think that this is the ordered state? One, right? You do?
Yeah.
Just one? Nobody else? Come on, guys, you all have to vote. Just like randomly guess. Machines also can randomly guess, like the machine learning algorithm. So you can also guess.
So trust me, I always have a very bad luck.
No, it's fine. So you think this one? How many people think this one?
I think it's right.
Okay, so a few more people think it's this one. So which one is it? I actually don't remember which one it is. Yeah, it turns out it's 4 of you are right. But it's not easy. I don't think, like, maybe you're convincing yourself that, I don't know, up in this left-hand corner there's more black spins or something like that. But there's also regions like that here. It just maybe doesn't stand out quite as much. So anyway, this is just to emphasize that this is a really difficult problem to do using machine learning. Well, if you use the right architecture. So what we're actually going to see is that it's actually really hard for the feet-forward neural network to do this. We're actually going to have to make improvements to the network structure in order to identify this. So we'll see that more next week, actually. Yeah, okay. Any questions? Okay, see you guys this afternoon then.